Okay, welcome to the last morning of the conference. Our first speaker,
right, if you need to introduce him, John Stacher from Boston, who will talk on projective and conformal structures in general.
Thank you, Carla. It's a pleasure for me to be here, and I guess it may sound ritual, and the organizers are perhaps getting tired of hearing it, but it's really from the heart. Thank you very much for inviting me and giving me opportunity to speak to the group here, really. Gracias. This work is being done in collaboration with Mahala Iftime. Discussion today, the last day of the conference, thank you for the happy few who came this morning. I hope they won't be the unhappy few by the end of my talk. I'm going to concentrate on conceptual issues and not so much formalism, although there will be some towards the end. So I think we've heard enough about this. The great problem is to combine a background independent dynamical approach with fixed absolute background space-time structures on which quantum theory is based. How can we combine these two? And our goal is to contribute to the development of a background-independent, non-perturbative approach to quantization of the gravitational field based on the conformal and projective structures of space-time. Outlining the talk, what quantization is and is not, measurement analysis and quantization, primacy of processes, space-time structures, conformal and projective structures, the rational principle based on them, and hopes for the future. What quantization is and is not. Here I will be discussing some of the issues, particularly that Borlaug discussed, but from a rather different point of view. What is not being claimed here is that quantization only makes sense when it applies to fundamental structures or entities. There's a sort of mystique surrounding quantum mechanics, and I quote from an old paper of mine when I was discussing quantum logic about 20 years ago. Anything touched by this formalism therefore seems to be elevated or should be lowered to a fundamental ontological status. The very words quantum mechanics conjure up visions of electrons, photons, baryons, mesons, neutrinos, quarks, and other exotic building blocks of the universe. But the scope of quantum mechanical formalism is by no means limited to such presumed fundamental particles. We never know, after all. There is no restriction in this principle on its application. A restrictional principle to the application of any physical system. One could apply the formalism to sewing machines if there were any reason to do so. What is quantization then? And I have here the plaque that's put up in honor of Max Planck at the Berlin University where he worked. Max Planck, the discoverer of the elementary quantum of action. Quantization is just a way of accounting for the effects of H, the elementary quantum of action, on any process undergone by some system, whether it's fundamental or composite, makes no difference. And here I'll say a little bit more detail. It's a reclassifying some system, or rather, and you should always remember, you have no direct contact with reality. Our contact with reality is always through theoretical systems, through theoretical models. So it's really the effect of the existence of the quantum of action on theoretical models of such a system, whether it's fundamental or composite. Composite in the sense that the collective behavior of a set of more fundamental entities is being quantized. And I remind you what Niels Bohr once said about the quantum of action. This is not a trivial thing, but just the effect of quantum of action. Anyone who is not busy after first acquaintance with the quantum of action has not understood a word. I'm going to give a little more detail what he means. The quantum of action is an element of wholeness in physical processes, and this element is called the universal quantum of action, discovered by Max Planck, and you understand that the ordinary laws of physics, classical mechanics, electrodynamics, are idealizations that can only be applied in the analysis of phenomena in which action involved at every stage is large compared to the quantum, so that the latter can be completely disregarded. Just to give you some examples, this has been going on for a long time, the application of quantum mechanics to non-fundamental processes. Quasi-particles, particle entities arising in certain systems of interacting particles, such as fermions and rotons in hydrodynamics, which were introduced by Landau in 1941. Curiously enough, another Russian introduced phenomenological photons. You can quantize electromagnetic waves in homogeneous isotropic dielectric, which is clearly not fundamental, but one gives very important physical results out of this, as Ginzburg realized as early as 1940. And this process goes on and on. Just a few days ago, I came across a paper in Nature, in a new type of non-fundamental quantum discovered, a polariton. Just a few rates of adherence state of electromagnetic waves is known as a laser. The adherence state of matter waves is termed a bosonic condensate. So what if a particle is a mixture of an electromagnetic wave and matter? Can such particles form coherent state? What does it look like? And the answer is, yes, they can. If the microcavity is the right width, the energies of the cavity photon and the exciton can be made to match up, and you get a new particle, which is called an exciton polariton, or simply a polariton. And these have a mass which is much more than the mass of the electron, for example. And yet these are very important for physical processes, as these articles would indicate. So I just want to indicate that this is an ongoing process. It's not that we're finished with discovering new ways of applying the quantum field of action to composite systems. So a successful quantization of subclassical formulas does not mean that one has achieved a deeper understanding of reality, or better, an understanding of a deeper level of reality. It means that one has successfully understood the effects of the quantum field of action on the phenomena or processes. Here, I prefer the word phenomena, find them prefer the word processes, but I'm using them synonymously here, described by the formalism. So having passed beyond the quantum mystique, one is free to explore how to apply quantization techniques to various formulations of the theory without the need to single one of these out as a unique right answer. One might say, quoting a famous Chinese leader, that 100 flowers blossom, but 100 schools can tend. Hopefully our 100 flowers will blossom more peacefully than in the Chinese example. So I give 3 miles of this tale. If 2 such quantizations at different levels are carried out, one may then investigate the relation between them. Crenshaw, for example, has demonstrated a limited equivalence between microscopic and macroscopic quantizations of the electromagnetic field in a dielectric. So, if one has different quantizations which apply to the same system at different levels, and then investigates the relation between them. This is an interesting physical problem. In other words, there can be many truths, and then the problem is to find the relationship between these truths, not to choose one over the other. If 2 such quantizations are carried out at the same level, then they also demonstrate the relation between them. For example, the relation of loop quantization and the usual field quantization of the electromagnetic field. And it turns out that if you thicken the loops, they're equivalent, as Ashtekar and Novelli showed in 1992. And I think this thickening is important in terms of the next question I'll be discussing, measurability. It seems to indicate that the measurement process must involve some space-time region rather than just a point. The second moral of this tale is the search for a method of quantizing space-time structures associated with the Einstein equations is distinct from the search for an underlying theory of all fundamental interactions. And I think there's a lot of confusion about this issue, which, without naming names, I think that sometimes has occurred in the course of this meeting. Not that I'm not terribly impressed by what you wrote, but let's clearly bear in mind these are 2 separate issues. Can one find a method of quantizing space-time structures associated with Einstein equations is a different question from is there some underlying deeper theory which relates Einstein theory with other theories? And here I quote Carlo Rovelli, I see no reason why quantum theory of gravity should not be sought within a standard interpretation of quantum mechanics with everyone traverses. A common argument is that in the Copenhagen interpretation, the observer must be external. But it's not possible to be external from the gravitational field, and he says if this were so, then this would apply just to the Maxwell field. You can consistently use the Copenhagen interpretation to describe the interaction between a macroscopic classical apparatus and a quantum gravitational phenomena happening, say, in a small region of macroscopic space-time. The fact that the motion of space-time breaks down at short scale within this region does not prevent us from having the region interacting with an external Copenhagen observer. A third model is that an attempt to quantize the performance of projective structures does not negate and need not replace attempts to quantize other space-time structures. Something in, one has 2 such quantizations, the problem is to get the relation between them. Everything depends on the utility of the results in explaining some physical processes. The important thing is what physical processes are you going to describe. And that brings me to the next question, measurability analysis and quantization. One simple method of taking into account the quantum of action is by means of introducing commutation relations between various particles in non-relativistic quantum mechanics or fields in special relativistic quantum field quantities into the formalism. But these commutation relations have more than a purely formal significance. And here I want to pay tribute to Peter Bergman, who many of you had the privilege of meeting, but I think some of the younger people might have even heard his name. He sort of dropped out of the literature. But he was not only a collaborator with Einstein, he was a pioneer in the study of quantization of general covariant theories, including general relativity. And he introduced this concept of measurability analysis and applied it to the linearized gravitational field. And there's a quote from this paper. Measurability analysis identifies those dynamical field variables that are susceptible to observation and measurement. And remember, this is the aim of every physical theory, to finally produce some physical quantities which are susceptible to observation and measurement. Observables is a word which has gotten into the quantum mechanical lingo, but it doesn't have to give them an operational significance. These observables can, the computation of their values can allow a lot of theoretical work. It's just that there are some quantities in theory which, by some means or other, you can then pin down the values of. So you have to then investigate what extent limitations inherent in their experimental determination, due to the existence of the quantum of action, are consistent with the uncertainties predicted by the formal theory. So the uncertainties predicted by the formal theory, for example, by the introduction of commutation relations, are not just a formal uncertainty. They must be shown to be consistent with the possibilities of idealized measurements. And what Bergman and Smith do, they did a measured multi analysis of the linearized general relativity, two ways of mass, the spin tube field, show that the limits of co-measurability of electric and magnetic components of the linear Humann tensor coincide with the limits of co-definability imposed by the covariant commutation relations. And I regard this as a very important prototype for the kind of thing that must be done, as you will see. And I'm going to also point out, as in the Bohr-Rosenfeld analysis of the co-measurability of electric and magnetic field components, a classic work in the field, rather than test point particle, they have to use averages over test bodies occupying space-time regions, and with a similar treatment to the commutation relations, which again suggests that the point approach must be transcended. Langer and Powell thought they found a contradiction in quantum electrodynamics because they tried to use the point approach. One must use averages over space-time regions to get consistency, as indicated here. Interestingly enough, Lewis Klein has come to a similar conclusion in a very recent work. The ideal foundation for a quantum theory of gravity would begin with the description of a quantum mechanical measurement of some part of the geometry of some region, proceed to analysis of the commutation relations in different observations, and then hypothesize a mathematical structure for space-time which would contain these relations and give general relativity a classical limit. We do not know how to do this at present, unfortunately. And in a recent paper of mine, I've again tried to make this point. Measurability analysis is based on the relation between formalism and observation. Its aim is to shed light on the physical implications of any formalism. The possibility of formally defining any physically significant quantity should coincide with the possibility of measuring it in principle. That is, the means of some idealized measurement procedure that is consistent with the formalism. So I want to emphasize this is, again, a theoretical process, but one uses idealized measurements. This is not empiricism or operationalism. And I also want to point out that measurement analysis is not, has nothing to do with the so-called measurement problem of quantum mechanics, collapse of wave packets or anything like that, which to me, following Feynman, are pseudo-problems. So non-relativistic quantum mechanics, the work of Heisenberg, and special relativistic quantum electrodynamics, the work of Bohr-Rosenfeld alluded to, have both passed this test. And in the recent paper with Giovanni Amore and Marino Camilla, we again share the point of view emphasized by Heisenberg and Bohr and Rosenfeld that the limits of definability of the quantity within any formalism should coincide with the limits of measurability of that quantity for all conceivable ideal measurement procedures. For all established theories, this criterion can be tested. For example, in spite of a serious challenge, source-free quantum electrodynamics was shown to pass this test. And that's the work of Bohr and Rosenfeld I alluded to. In the case of quantum gravity, our situation is rather the opposite. In the absence of a fully accepted rigorous theory, exploration of the limits of measurability of various quantities considered a tool to provide clues in the search for such a theory. If we are fairly certain of the results of our measurability analysis, the proposed theory must be fully consistent with these results. And now, processes are primary. And here I found no better statement exists than the beautiful statement of Lee Smolin. Relativity theory and quantum theory each, this is one of the features they have in common. Each tell us, no better they scream at us, that our world is a history of processes. Motion and change are primary. Nothing is, except in a very approximate and temporary sense. How something is, or what its state is an illusion. It may be a useful illusion for some purposes, but if we want to think fundamentally, we must not lose sight of the essential fact that is an illusion. So to speak the language of the new physics, we must learn a vocabulary in which process is more important than empirical stasis. And concretely, this means that when one talks about state functions, state vectors, and so on, these are useful devices for computing probability amplitudes for a process. They should not be taken seriously in and for themselves. That's the moral of this. And Carlo Rovelli gave us a beautiful demonstration of how to apply this approach in the search for the quantum theory of gravity. Since he went over this in detail, I won't do anything more than... unfortunately, I see some of my symbols have not come out. Well, unfortunately. But the main thing is that when it takes a bounded region of space-time, one establishes data on the surface of the region, and then one computes a probability amplitude for the process described in the interior of the region. Following Feynman's intuition, you can formally define this amplitude in terms of the sum of the bulk field configurations, etc. However, in general, the field includes the gravitation. In general, the background independent formalism means that the result must be independent of the formal for the surface. Therefore, the field depends, the gravity better with probability amplitude depends only on the boundary values of the fields. However, the field includes the gravitational field, and the gravitational field determines the space-time structure. Therefore, the dependence of W on the field is still sufficient to code the relative distance and time separation of the components of the measurement apparatus. And I'm just emphasizing what Carlo so beautifully demonstrated to us the other day. What is happening is that in a background-dependent quantum field theory, we have two kinds of measurements, those that determine the distances of the parts of the apparatus and the time elapsed between measurements, and the actual measurements of the fields, the dynamical variables. In quantum gravity, instead, distance and time separation are on an equal footing with the dynamical fields. This is the core of the general law of physical evolution, and the key for background-independent quantum field theory, to which I say amen. So now, as an example, I pointed out loops, but what kind? Loop integrals and the holonomies may well be the most suitable set of observables for quantization. But loop integrals of the one form, which are what we were talking about basically, are independent of all other space-time structures. These loop integrals of two forms, surface integrals of two forms and so forth. We are able to find the loops for spatial hypersurfaces, as in the usual canonical formalism. And to show that this is not just a theoretical question, I point out that there are two Aharon-Abraham effects. The magnetic one involving space-like loops, and the electric one involving time-like loops. And on the surface data of Carlo's surface sigma, one should be able to induce both these types of loops and make a fitting. In terms of the model differential geometry, a Aharon-Abraham effect can be understood to be the holonomy of the complex valued line model representing the electromagnetic field. The connection on the line bundle is given by electromagnetic potential A, and thus the electromagnetic field strength is the curvature of the line bundle, F, dA. The integral of A around the closed loop is the holonomy. Just as the phase of the wave function depends upon a magnetic vector potential, it also depends upon the scalar electric potential. By constructing a situation in which the electrostatic potential varies for two pairs of the particle, through regions of zero electric field, an observable Aharon-Abraham effect is the unit effect on the phenomenon, on the phase shift has been predicted, and again, in the absence of electric field, possibly there would be no such effect. And this has been experimentally verified within the last 10 years. Now we come to space-time structures. There are a number of space-time structures that play an important role in general theory of relativity, and the first part of this will be a sort of review of what I think everybody knows. Pseudometric tensor field, Minkowski, the kernel geometry is represented mathematically by a pseudo-Riemannian-metric tensor field on a four-dimensional manifold. And Riemann told us how to go from gravity including the local Euclidean, assuming that the spatial metric is local Euclidean, but gravity non-flat. There's a curvature that varies from point to point. Now, what kind of curvature? Well, it turns out there are two kinds. Gauss introduced the surface curvature, of a two-surface, and it's very hard to see what this has to do with gravitation. However, Riemann extended Gauss's ideas about curvature from two-dimensional surface to higher dimensions, and related this to the metric Riemann test. I see all the indices are going to be absent from this talk, so this talk will be even less technical than I intended. I apologize. But there's another kind of curvature, much more important for geometrizing gravitation. And the absence of this concept actually held up Einstein for 2.5 years in the search for general relativity. To understand this, you must go back to Grassmann and affine spaces, in which parallelism is all. And that's Grassmann. Forget about distance, keep the concept of parallel lines. Only the ratio of parallel intervals has meaning and so forth and so on. I won't go into any detail about that. And there's a curvature associated with that. And Tullio di Civita did for affine space what Riemann had done for Euclidean space. He went from global to local, and this is in order a new interpretation of curvature to the concept of parallel displacement. And I just remind you what parallel displacement, when you go around a closed loop, you don't get back to the same result of this curvature. And this leads it to the concept of the equation of geodesic deviation. Is there any relative acceleration between two nearby freely flowing test bodies? And the amount of such relative accelerations in various directions is a measure of the components of the affine curvature tensor. And Hermann Weyl was the first one to clearly emphasize that the inertial gravitational field is represented by a symmetric affine connection on the space-time manifold. And again, the symbols are missing. And Einstein, by the way, by the end of the talk, fully recognized the importance of this, that the affine connection is it's much more fundamental, and the metric center is the auxiliary potential for the connection. But the delta deviation, of course, physically equals tidal forces, and even Wikipedia recognizes this, so that this is immediately, one can associate this mathematics directly with gravitation. I just point out that parenthetically, the power of displacement is really what I call a post-Latour concept. Everybody knows what premature means, but there are also post-Latour concepts. Gehring went from global Euclidean to local Euclidean with Gaussian periphery in 1854. Grassmann developed his global affine geometry in 1844-1862. Someone should have gone from global affine to local affine with affine curvature by 1888 at the latest, but no one did, and Einstein suffered grievously from that lack. Sometimes said Einstein had all the mathematical tools he needed. That is not true. He was missing the concept of the connection. And of course, there are incompatibility conditions between the two, essentially that the covariant unit of the metric with respect to the affine connection should vanish. And the physical interpretations of these we have, I would just emphasize two things. It tells us that the preferred affine parameter must be the same as the, well, for time like this, must be the same as the proper time, up to linear transformation, of course. But I realize that in this point of view, both the preferred affine parameter and the proper time are there. One in the affine connection and the other in the metric. And similarly, it also gives us a relation between the variant structure, which is inherent in the metric, and the trace of the affine connection. I'll come back to interpretation of that. But both the variant structure and the proper time are there in this interpretation, the relations between them. Well, here I give some other physical coverage to that. Originally, Einstein started with the second-order formalism, and of course Hilbert then showed how to derive this from a Lagrangian, second-order Lagrangian. And this is still the route followed by most textbooks, unfortunately. But it's also possible to note a cheap metric and connection as independent structures, and then derive the compatibility connections between them to deal with first-order field equations from the so-called Palatini variational missile, which was not really what Palatini did, but Einstein called it Palatini variational missile, and so it's been known. In this approach, metric and connection are in a sense dual, like coordinates of momenta in mechanics. A major technical advance in the canonical quantization problem came when, rather than taking the three metric as coordinates, geometric dynamics, Astakar and his group took the three connection as the coordinates, and that led us to loop quantum gravity. So this metric connection duality is extremely important. And either of these approaches, I want to point out, came combined with the tertiary formalism. I won't bother with this. So now we're going to talk about formal and projective structures, finally. But neither metric nor connection is irreducible. When you go a step further and decompose both metric and affine connections themselves. In homogeneous flat geometries, metric geometry is a special case of conformal geometry, and affine geometry is a special case of projective geometry. And here I just remind you very briefly of Fritz Klein's Erlangen program, which Hoxha points out has remarkable power of unified situations which Klein himself had not yet envisaged. People at that time were very, in the middle of the last century, middle of the 19th century, were very confused by the fact that different geometries can coexist. Klein pointed out they can coexist because they deal with different types of propositions and invariances with different types of symmetry transformations. By extracting the underlying symmetry groups from the geometry, the relation between the geometries can be established at the group theoretical level. And, for example, the symmetry affine and projective geometry can be understood in this way. I think, in view of time, I won't go into detail. Eric Cartan then did two things. He took conformal and projective structures from global to local. He introduced the concept of local conformal and projective structures in these two papers. And he also generalized the whole idea of Klein. These structures and Cartan connection are continuation of the Klein program in spaces that are only locally flat in the appropriate sense of that word. You keep the local group, but drop the translation and replace them with some non-flat Cartan connection. And this is ultimately what led to the whole fiber bundle approach, because Cartan realized you could do this not only with subgroups of the general linear group, but you could attach any structure to each point of the manifold, and that has led to the whole fiber bundle approach. If I'm touching the floor bar in defining property of the metric, then that's the conformal structure on the manifold. Physically, this conformal structure represents the causal structure of space-time, and one can measure the conformal structure of space-time by using massless test entities. I don't say bodies, but body seems to suggest mass to me. So I distinguish massless test entities and massive bodies. My equations are not here, but they're so trivial. The Laplanian equation for light is invariant on conformal transformations, and light rays are about characteristics of this equation. So by using massless test entities, one can measure the conformal structure. Projective structure. Similarly, if one abstracts from the preferred parameterization, proper length along phase light and proper time along time light curves of the affine parallel curves associated with the affine structure, affine connection, one gets projective structure on the manifold. So sometimes people distinguish between paths, which are unparameterized, and curves, which are parameterized. In fact, Eisenhardt wrote a book about projective geometry called The Geometry of Paths, the unparameterized things. Physically, projective structure picks out the class of preferred paths in space-time, and one can measure the projective structure by using massive test bodies. All my equations are missing. But the point is, you can always add a term to the connection, which depends only on an arbitrary vector, not to read the paths, but of course change the connection. So these quantities only affect the trace of the affine connection, so if you pull out the trace, you can form projectively wearing quantities by moving the trace. And again, unfortunately, all the equations did not survive the transfer to this machine. But anyway, one has now objective structure, which is associated with projective parameters. Now, Euler's parameter and Schild, I have here where you can, Euler's picture, he's only known to be still active in the field. Felix Klein has moved on to greener pastures, and unfortunately Alfred Schild died quite young. They emphasize the importance of conformal projective structures as leading to the metric structure in this paper, Geometry of Free Fall and Light Propagation. Geometry of Space-Time has a conformal Lorentzian structure that explains the phenomenon of light propagation, that obtained a Lorentzian metric structure of space-time just as in general relativity. These authors carried out the following steps. First, in the use of projective structure, represents the measurement of free test particles. Notice they use particles, suffering gravitational effects only. Then a comparability condition is necessary to link the projective and conformal structures in order to obtain a symmetric linear connection, the so-called Weyl connection. But this still leaves, we'll see, the conformal structure unfixed. This mathematical condition is physically justified by the experimental fact that a particle with mass can be made to chase a photon arbitrarily closely. Finally, introduce the axiom which affirms that the Ricci tensor of the connection must be symmetric so that the Weyl connection becomes a linear connection associated with the Lorentzian metric, and this then fixes the conformal factor. Once this axiom has been physically justified, they deduce the coexistence of the existence of a Lorentzian metric structure in Ricci, determined except for a constant factor, of course. Compatibility between the causal and projective structures can be defined leading to a Weyl connection, and then a second compatibility condition guarantees the existence of a metric compatible with the affine connection. I want to emphasize each of these compatible conditions. If the first compatible condition is obeyed, the affine connection is fixed uniquely. So the concept of proper time, remember you start out with the behavior of massless entities for the conformal structure, behavior of massive entities for the projective structure. But now if the first compatible condition is obeyed, the concept of the affine connection is fixed. So the concept of proper time emerged along the time-like world, and of course on similar proper length, but for physical purposes, the proper time is more important. This emerges from this condition. It is not built in at the beginning, as it would be if you started from the metric affine point of view. And similarly, this subject to a second clock effect. Two initially synchronous clocks will not run at the same rate when reunited. And this was the reason for Einstein's rejecting Weyl's original unified field theory. Spectral lines give us essentially good clocks, and we know that spectral lines, the rates of the behavior of spectral lines is independent of the histories, and this tells us the second clock effect apparently does not exist in nature. But the second compatibility condition takes care of this. If it is obeyed, the second clock effect disappears, but more important from my point of view, the conformal factor is fixed, so the unique floor value amount is defined. You don't start with that, but it emerges from the second compatibility condition. So proper time emerges from the first compatibility condition, proper volume emerges from the second compatibility condition. And here we've got a diagram which explains some of the very intricate mathematical relations between all these quantities, but I don't how much time do I have left? Okay. I can say a little bit about this then. Essentially, we show some relation between these, you put the conformal and projective structure with compatibility conditions, well, I guess I have this. You put conform, oh, I hit the wrong button, sorry. Oh, I'm going backwards. Is that visible? Okay, if you hit the informal structure and combine it with the projective structure, you get the vowel connection with the first compatible condition. Then if you add that second compatible condition, you get the linear symmetric connection. There should be a line connecting that with the Lorentz metric. That leads you to the Lorentz metric. And there are various other relations between all these quantities, which I will not take the time to go into. So summarizing this point, conformal structure is measured by massless test entities. Projective structure is measured by massive test entities. The first compatibility condition, from the first compatibility condition, the concept of proper time emerges. From the second compatibility condition, the concept of proper field volume emerges, not filled in initially. Now, the variational principle, I'm afraid we're not going to see much of this because the indices and so forth won't be there, but I can sort of outline what happens. Well, the new Palatini-type variational principle, it turns out. This is sort of here's the indication that we're on an interesting track. I'm not claiming more for the less. In the manifold with metric, it's conformal and affine structures suffice to determine that metric up to an overall constant factor. Weyl noted that as early as 1921, and Higgsy nobody really picked it up until Ehlers, Polanyi, and Schill came along and tried to apply it to the modern approaches. But this circumstance enabled us to set up a new first-order Palatini-type variational principle for general relativity. You do a further breakup. You break up the metric into its volume-determining part, essentially the determinant of the metric, and its conformal causal structure-determining part, which has a unit determinant. Break up the affine connection into its projective preferred path determining part, the trace field part of the connection, it turns out, and its preferred parameter determining part, the trace field part, the trace part is the preferred parameter determining part. Each of these four parts may then be weighed independently in the variational principle. The pseudometric view can be built up out of two parts. I don't know why some of these came up. Sort of graphicalized view, which is determinant, one part, which is tensor density of 8 minus a half, the determinant minus 1, invariant of the conformal transformations. The second part, the scalar density, which can come out here, I call it gamma, is density of weight plus a half, so the power of the two is a tensor, and it transforms the conformal transformations well in the ways you see. And then you define the metric, so in this way of doing things, you start from the conformal structure and the scalar density part, and you build up the metric in that way with its inverse index free notation, or half index free notation, unfortunately. Since the determinant of the conformal part is minus one, the components of its inverse are cubic functions of the components of the lower one. So the variational principle of Lagrangian is cubic in these variables, and that might be important for quantization. One has a purely algebraic. By making that determinant one, one gets rid of this infinite series, and one has a purely algebraic relation between the co and contravariant components of this quantity. Similarly, the connection we built up out of two parts, P, the traceless part, and the trace. And the traceless part is invariant under projective transformations, and the second part transforms under projective transformations as well. There should be a gradient of a quantity there, of that quantity T. And then how it's built up, unfortunately, you can't see that here. I want to point out there are conformal curvature tensor associated with the decomposition of the Riemann tensor, the conformal curvature tensor, often called the Weyl tensor, and the parts depend on the Ricci, tensor by the Ricci and the Ricci scalar, Ricci tensor and the Ricci scalar. The conformal tensor, well, these are just some interesting properties has which make it very easy to do the relational calculation. Similarly, there's projective curvature tensor, the affine curvature tensor can be formed from the affine connection as first derivatives can be written in terms of the projective part and its derivatives, and there's a decomposition of the affine curvature, etc. Unfortunately, you can't see it. But this definition simplifies the breakup of the affine curvature tensor, which has very simple transformation laws under projective transformations. And the projective curvature tensor is invariant under projective transformation, so it cannot depend on the trace part. This simplifies the variational principle considerably. Lagrangian tensor is then usual Palatini-Lagrangian, but now with four variables, and you take variables in respect to all four. I apologize again, one can't see the quantities, but I guess hope the basic idea comes across. One has four quantities here, and one varies in respect to all four. Variation in respect to the projective structure and the give took the fallibility conditions to be a form of objective structure. It's just the fallibility conditions we've been talking about earlier, but they now emerge from the relational principle. The first one, the first fallibility condition, is just what we would hope. It implies that in a form of objective structures together define a Weyl space. So this essentially just shows that how that follows mathematically. Of course, without the indices, you can't follow the derivation, but that condition, that first condition emerging from the variation principle is essentially the definition of the force of the projective connection and the conformal connection, projective and conformal structures to be related in a way that produces a Weyl space. This is just the details of the derivation of that. The undefined connection so defined is actually unique in the Weyl space, but if one carries out a conformal transformation on metric, and a corresponding conformal transformation takes place, which leaves the connection invariant. Thus, in the Weyl space, the connection is fixed, but the metric is fixed only to conformal factor, as I said earlier. Again, I say this emerges from the variational principle. Now, if you impose a second compatibility condition, this forces this factor, which leaves a conformal structure unreturned, forces it to vanish, and we then have a pseudo-Riemann metric and a connection. Now this backup for me is especially interesting because of its relation to the Coulson set approach to quantum gravity, developed by Rothfeld Sorkin, but really much of the early work of Kornheimer and Penrose is very relevant here. This essentially is based on taking the conformal structure and the full volume structure as the primary constituents of the classical theory, and then replacing them by discretized versions. So the causal set approach combines the two ideas of discreteness, the volume structure, and order, conformal structure, produce a structure on which the theory of quantum gravity can hopefully be based. However, in causal set theory, the quantization of the full volume is simply considered by hand, one just asserts it. And no attention has been paid to the dual affine connection, hence the possibility of finding quantum analogs of the traceless, projective, and trace parts of this connection does not exist. And no real quantization has been achieved from my point of view because where is H in this story? But this, in other words, I hope this approach will supplement the causal approach by introducing those missing projective parts. So I hope to see the future. For those who know German, this is called Zukunftsmusik. It's just promissory notes. But at least I tell you the kind of things that we're working on. We want to extend the classical measurability analysis of the form of projective structures from point particles to extended massless test entities and massive test bodies. That's fairly simple to do. Then, investigate the effects of the quantum action on the measurability and co-measurability of these structures. Measurability, so these quantities defined as really measurable. Co-measurability is sort of limits on their co-measurability, which imposed by the existence of the quantum action, and see what this implies about the possible commutation relations between them. And I emphasize this is a point which should be done in any physical theory of quantum gravity, but when you tell us what your basic entities are, you must show us how we can physically measure those quantities and what the implications on your co-measurability due to the use of quantum action, how this relates to the commutation relations that you postulate. You cannot just postulate formal commutation relations, they must have some physical consequences, and again, emphasize measurability analysis is the discussion of what those physical consequences are or should be. Then, as I just indicated, you investigate the effect of the quantum action on these compatibility conditions. In particular, what are the implications for the possible quantization of the proper time and the proper flow volume? As I said, in this formalism, the proper time and the proper flow volume emerge from the compatibility conditions, and therefore, if one has properly quantized the conformal and projective structures, the hope, as I say, it's just a promissory note, but if one has done this, there should then be implications on the question of the quantization of proper time and proper flow volume. Then, when one could relate this to the loop and harmony approaches, we formulate the whole theory in terms of Cartan connections and curvatures for the conformal and projective structures. Investigate the conformal and projective polynomials. And recently, mathematicians have put a great deal of work into this. I came across a thesis from Oxford on just the harmonies of projective and conformal structures. So a great deal of mathematical work has been done. One has to investigate how this applies to this, from a mathematician's point of view, the kind of baby talk we're talking here. They have a very elaborate mathematical machine doing the problems to try to translate it into the forms which we can apply. And then once the one is done, they say, therefore, the relation to loop quantum gravity, which is based on the metric, the holonomies of the metric and affine connection. To confirm this, Dr. singles out null hypersurfaces, which suggests the application of null hypersurface quantization techniques. And null hypersurfaces break up into 2 plus 1, naturally, space-like 2 surfaces plus null congruences, suggesting the use of conformal 2 structure as a dynamical degrees of freedom of the field. Conformal 2 structure is a concept that Adrian Vernon and I introduced about 20, 30 years ago as a way of describing the 2 degrees of freedom of the gravitational field. On null hypersurfaces, they can be prescribed without any constraints, which makes it very interesting. Then we hope to apply this to a baby midi superspace model, carry out this quantization program for cylindrical wave models with both degrees of polarization. That's the interest of this model. The only model I know, midi superspace model, we have both degrees of polarization present, so you have two interacting fields, non-linear interacting, and compare this with the existing results on the quantization of cylindrical waves. So my final summary, classically, the conformal projective structures provide a sort of minimal basis for constructing Lorentzian space-times based on the behavior of massless and massive entities. Study of quantization seems A, worthwhile, not B, but A worthwhile having the approach to the problem of quantum gravity. Thank you.
Thank you very much. John, sorry for the patience.
Yes. Hopefully you ironed that out before playing the internet.
Yeah, exactly. You made it very clear, and I realize that sometimes without equations it's better, it's easier to understand.
Questions? Is it not working?
I can say louder. Could you comment on the relation of this with Ted Newman's surface formalism?
That's a very good question. I have my answer to it, but I should probably add that to my program of research. Do you have any specific
idea? No, to me that was similar. You have these null surfaces, and then I think you have another scalar function that somehow establishes volumes.
Yeah, it is true that one can derive the metric structure directly from just the conformal and the volume structure. And some people have proposed that, but I feel that somehow when the metric plus the affine, it's so important to have the affine, it seems to me that when one goes that step from metric to conformal, one could simply go from affine to projective, because one is related to the behavior of massless entities, the other is related to the behavior of massive entities. The volume structure somehow is not so intuitive to me why that should be there from the beginning. My 100 flowers in schools of thought content. My own personal feeling is I like an approach in which both proper time and proper volume emerge, and therefore the question of their quantization becomes a question to be answered by the formula rather than something one has to build in from the beginning. But it's certainly a very good question. I haven't thought of it, and I have to look into that. Thank you.
Any questions? Does the mic work? I have one.
Well, what do you want to just take into this?
No, it's okay.
Okay.
I was intrigued by your insistence that the commutation relations actually have a direct physical meaning, because they tell us what quantum effects do on the non.
Well, I would put it a little more honestly. If you choose the right physical quantities to impose a commutation relation. You can, of course, impose commutation relations on non-physical quantities and derive the commutation relation. But if you're claiming that these are the physically measurable quantities,
right,
then I claim, yeah.
Ah, yes. Have you reflected, had any thought of some, I can see also in generativity how this happens sort of very abstractly, theoretically, but have you reflected how the effect of this could come down toward measurable, measurable things, which we could be solved for measuring. Do you have any?
Yes, my hypothesis is that the conformal structure and the projective structure will lead to such entities. So I think as a first step, what I do is go back over the Bergman-Smith analysis, which was done in terms of the Riemann tensor defined from the metric, and try to reanalyze that in terms of conformal and projective structures. If it is, as a general rule, if it doesn't work in a linear case, it's not going to work in general. The Humboldt, unfortunately, is not true. Many things work in a linear case which don't work in general. But what I would do as a first step is try to apply this procedure to the linearized versions of the conformal and projective structures. And if encouraging results come there, hopefully that will give us hints how to proceed further. Yeah.
Other questions?
Thank you. I got this here. Oh.